Hi, this is Scott Snibbe, host of A Skeptic's Path to Enlightenment. We've just launched a new online community called Train a Happy Mind, where I'm leading weekly live meditations for all the topics I've shared in our podcast and on the How to Train a Happy Mind book. The community also offers classes, discussion groups, and special events. Anyone is welcome to join for free or by donation. Visit our new community website at trainahappymind.org to sign up. I look forward to seeing you there. A Skeptic's Path to Enlightenment is a nonprofit organization supported entirely by your donations. If you've ever enjoyed one of our podcast episodes or classes, please consider making a donation of any size right now on our website at skepticspath.org. I'm Scott Snibbe, and this is A Skeptic's Path to Enlightenment, where we explore practical ideas from Buddhism that build happier lives, stronger relationships, and a better world. After ordination by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Scott Tusa spent 9 years as a Tibetan Buddhist monk. Today, he's an irreverent meditation teacher and a brand new father. In this episode, Scott and I talk about some hard decisions we've faced in life and that the world faces today, asking ourselves, what is the right thing to do? Is there a right and wrong from a Buddhist perspective? And how did Scott and I deal with the painful decisions we faced in our lives to get divorced and to give up a monastic life? We also grapple with one of the biggest ethical dilemmas facing the world today, the violent conflict in Israel and Gaza. So, Scott, I'm excited to have you back on the podcast. You're one of the, strangely, the many Scots that I've been close with over the years. And it's a pleasure having you back to talk about this meaty topic of what is the right thing to do.
Yeah, thanks so much, Scott. It's really always a pleasure to join you in conversation here. And two Scots are, you know, maybe better than one. We'll find out.
Been an unending joke for my many Scott friends over the years. Buddhism can be very abstract, and that can be appealing to a certain type of person. But to make this real, I wanted to ground it in our lives. And sure. In particular, for me, was when I got divorced. I'm married now, happily, but I was married once before, and I got divorced. There was a lot of conflict and problems, and you know, maybe it didn't seem like we were the best match after a while. But I took a vow, you know, I had a vow for a whole lifetime vow to honor, cherish, you know, stand by this person. And I took that really seriously. And also I had divorced parents. So I had made a vow to myself even before I got married, like, I'm never going to do what my parents did. I'm never going to get divorced like that. It's so bad. Did you go through anything similar, you know, as you were confronting that question of, you know, whether to remain a monk?
Definitely. For me, it wasn't that dissimilar to a marriage. Yeah. You know, it just wasn't, there wasn't another person involved. It was just like a set of vows and a lifestyle. And then I started to question like, oh, is this going to be something I can sustain and or want to sustain? Because I think for me in particular, the issue was more isolation. And I think I've talked about this on your podcast before, and which is fine. But it also left me kind of isolated without community. And I think if we're not having lovers and partners, and we don't also have community, it's sort of like there's just a point where our humanity, you can't do it anymore, which I think is kind of natural, you know?
You were lonely.
I was lonely. It just sort of was like, I know this is a right life to have. Like, I had no doubt that being a monk was good. It just was like more, okay, I don't know if I can sustain this anymore and be a healthy human being.
Yeah, you know, I think It's similar because as long as I was thinking, okay, well, even though this isn't pleasant for me, maybe it's the right thing. Maybe it's something I have to kind of grind through or learn through. But it was only when I kind of got transitioned into thinking whether it was the best thing for my wife that things started to open up again a couple years later. And this was through talking to teachers. Like I asked my teachers because I asked like Geshe Dakpa, Whenever I ask Geshe Dakpo a question, though, he never had an answer. He just say like, it doesn't matter, actually. That was his answer to almost every worldly thing I asked him, which I think kind of makes sense to a more realized person. But when I asked Venerable Sangye Kadro, you know, she said, well, yeah, you have to look very closely and see what's the benefit for her and for you and what's the harm. And if you've really reflected for a long time and found that is more harmful than beneficial, then for her sake as well as yours, it would make sense. And, you know, it's quite bold of her. I love Venerable Sangye Kadro because she'll always go very deep. And typically you wouldn't have someone, even your friends, or certainly not a Buddhist monk or nun, saying like, get divorced. But, you know, she's, I think through the wisdom of someone who's studied Buddhism for a long time, you're willing to go there. For me, that was kind of the door opening when I started to think not just about myself, which is important, I'm important, but also about what was the best thing for her. I don't know if there was like a similar cascade for you as you went through thinking about
it. I can relate to that in my partnerships, like what you're saying.
yeah.
For sure. We sound similar in a certain way because I have always this doubt of like, am I just following my attachment, right, with anything? And so I take a long time to make sure it's not just that. One of my main teachers, I couldn't see his advice completely, but I think his advice mostly was just like, just hang on, just like wait. He said, if you do what you need to do, was his advice. Like, he wasn't pressuring me in any way, but he was kind of like, just wait. And I really see the wisdom in that now, because if I could have hung on for, you know, 3, 4, 5 more years, you know, I don't know, I'm a different person now. But, you know, I'm also a different person now because I decided to give back the vows. Yeah.
You know, one of my heroes, who's not a Buddhist, but is very Buddhist sympathetic, is Stuart Brandt. And one thing he said that stuck with me, I heard before I became a Buddhist, he said, good things happen slowly, bad things happen fast. So I think one thing we're both already saying is just, you know, to slow down critical decisions, which you and I, these both took a few years. But the thing I wanted to ask you, there was a moment for me when the decision finally kind of collapsed into a certainty. There was a moment where a fight could have started with my ex-wife. I remember, you know, she kind of turned to me and she started saying like, you this, you that, blah, blah, blah. And I had this extraordinary moment where I just thought, I'm not anything. it's like it does, it's meaningless. Like what she's saying, it's just, there's no basis. I mean, there's some conventional basis to it, but there's nothing for me to get angry about. Like, it's a way that she's seeing things. It's not necessarily true or false. It's relative from her perspective. It was like, and it wasn't like I was just dismissing or ignoring what she was saying. Like, there's some truth to what she's saying. But in a greater sense, it's just like, wait, reality is much more flexible than this. And I don't have to respond. I don't have to push back. And, you know, I didn't react. And then that was the gateway out, because once I was not angry, like making a decision under the control of anger, I think is almost universally unhelpful. So that kind of dissolved the anger, finally. Dissolved the conflicts. Like, it had no more arguments or conflicts with her after that. And then I was able to think more clearly, again, what is beneficial, what's harmful, through therapy, through this, through that. And, you know, eventually did decide to get divorced. But it was a bit more harmonious. You know, we went through therapies and discussions, and yeah, there were some conflicts, but it was relatively, like, harmonious, as much as things like that can be. I wonder if you faced any other a gateway like that with, you know, relativity, emptiness, interdependence.
Yeah. I mean, I love it. I just love what you just shared. For me, it was maybe a little more simplistic at the time, with just with the example I'm using today of returning my monastic vows. It was more just like, you know, I finally, when I pressed my main teacher more, he was just sort of like, you know, do what you want to do. You know, do what you need to do. So yeah, for me, it was just like this relief, this certainty, like, I'm not perfect. I don't have to be a perfect monk. I don't have to be a perfect practitioner. I don't have to be a perfect person, but I definitely want to keep practicing the Dharma. And I just want to do that with a different lifestyle.
Yeah, I like what you're saying, because I did also have a similar, I think a lot of what was holding me back was this idea that I was a failure if I ended the relationship, you know, that I failed in marriage, failed in relationships, failed as a husband. And it was that kind of opening up to, again, through that like relativity, interdependence, like, well, I'm not a failure or a success. Like, I'm not, it's just, this is the thing that's happening. And to try to be skillful and to live as compassionate life as you can and do the right thing, as right of a thing as I could for each of us, harming the least, benefiting the most, with uncertainty, you know, knowing that I don't know for sure what's the best decision, but that, you know, we do need to make one. And, you know, fighting with someone every day is not a healthy way to live your life.
I've been there. Yeah, it's no fun.
Yeah. One of the things that surprised me the most when I first started studying Buddhism is I saw the Dalai Lama many, many times. And a few times people asked the Dalai Lama how to end war, which kind of starts to segue into our next topic. And I heard him several times. He gave the same answer, which is make up with the people you have conflicts with in your own life. He said that will be the greatest cause for peace. I don't think that would make intuitive sense to everybody. It didn't to me at the time, although it was very powerful. But it breaks through the idea that there's this separate, that there's a war outside there, and then there's just me. No, everything is made of individual people making individual decisions, and even our individual decisions, you know, here in a country far away, do affect conflicts in the Middle East and Eastern Europe and so on.
Yeah, nothing happens in a box. I think this is the beauty of interdependence as a teaching in Buddhism and practices that help us to access that. Because then we can start to ask more questions than have answers. Like, to me, what's so beautiful in His Holiness's expression there is, it's kind of a, it's not quite a question, but it's a prompt.
Yeah. I mean, what about this, why don't we, you know, as compassionately as possible, why don't we wade into this extremely painful, extremely divisive conflict in the Middle East right now? It's worth, in today's world too, it's probably important for us to acknowledge our own, you know, identities in the current language. You know, I come from a Jewish family, but we're not practicing Jews. I was raised Christian and then became a Buddhist. I've been to Israel. I have, you know, relatives who died in the Holocaust and things like that.
Yeah. And yeah, I grew up, you know, I had a bar mitzvah. Yeah. I went to Israel, you know, similar to you. And you know, I have a complex identity with being Jewish. And it's something that I'm always questioning and asking new questions about, you know? So yeah, I'd love to jump into that. And I think we probably have some unique perspectives because of that. Yeah.
As this topic has come up with, you know, different people on different sides of the debate over the last couple months, that's usually what I start with. And it's funny how shocked people are with the idea of nonviolence. You know, it's so fundamental to the Buddhist worldview that you start with nonviolence. Like, if nothing else, the very beginning is just nonviolence, to not harm.
You equate them, I don't necessarily equate them as the same, non-harm and nonviolence. But, you know, I see it more, and this isn't to contradict, I think it's just an interesting conversation we could have. I see Buddhist ethics more built in the foundation of non-harm, which has a little bit of a broader context. Because,
yeah, even broader than nonviolence, yeah.
Yeah, because, yeah, like violence can be interpreted, actually, right? Where harm can be defined.
Yeah.
And so I think there's, you know, and again, just raising it up, we don't have to open the gate, because it is a sensitive, that in itself is a sensitive topic. So I want to be careful there, yeah.
The example, my teacher, Valen Rene, you know, when he was talking about this, he said, here's a good way to think about, you know, when to use violence and how to use it. He said, imagine if anybody is trying to attack you or commit violence against you, think of them as your mother. Like, what if your mother came at you with a knife and you had a gun in your hand? What are you going to do? Are you going to shoot your mom? No, you're going to put down the gun. You're going to tackle her. You're likely going to sustain some pretty serious injuries, but you realize that she's acting under some powerful delusion. She needs to be subdued and prevented from being violent. And also to preserve your own life, like equally having equal concern for preserving her life and safety as well as your own, and then finding some, you know, overarching bigger solution to a problem that seems more rooted in mental delusion, you know, than a strong sense of enemy or friend. How do you think this bears on this current conflict?
I think what you just said about enemy and friend, that was the thing that kind of sparked me the most, because that is the thing that, you know, these binaries we create around our fixed ideas based on our reactive, destructive emotions, you know, to me, that is violent, you know, like that is harm, right?
Yeah.
So like when we get to the essence, a little bit more of what harm is, you know, this is where I kind of was reflecting on what you shared from His Holiness Dalai Lama, that, you know, harm is something that starts in our own minds, starts in our own emotions. And then eventually we act with our body and speech based on that if we don't work with it in a healthy way. So looking at it that way, I think it kind of gets into looking at harm, obviously a more inner way. And then, of course, like, I mean, you know, adding to our conversation, it's like, as you know, because you've been to Israel and you grew up Jewish as well, the worldviews at play in the Middle East are not the same worldviews at play for people who grew up in the United States. So even as like a growing up Reformed Judaism, but I was born in the United States, I was, you know, fed and or, you know, educated in a different form of what Israel-Palestinian conflict, you know, politics, all that meant versus what it actually means. Because there's only a certain amount I can connect with via the lenses I have. I think if that's not taken into account, how are we ever going to figure out, you know, what has less harm? Because we're not taking, you know, we're not taking our own worldview into account.
And even that is already very compassionate, right? Because compassion starts with empathy and acknowledging that there are different points of view. And to even see that, like, once you're there, you're already halfway toward a solution, right? Like if you're a very wounded Israeli person, and yet you can still see the level of wound and pain of Palestinians being bombed, having their children die in ways that, you know, Israelis had their children die. That's the path toward compassion and toward resolving a conflict. Even the Buddha said, right, only hatred comes from hatred. And it's so hard for people to hear that. And there's even, you know, there's very strong political movements on, you know, the extremes of both left and right perspective, where they really don't want to consider the other person's perspective. They say, you know, doing so limits your ability to be effective as an activist. And that is a little bit at odds with the Buddhist worldview, which is that, no, the roots of resolving conflict, peace, safety, security, human rights, are in acknowledging the fundamental human rights and needs for safety, security, food, shelter, love, compassion that all people have, right?
Totally. I mean, it gets back to, if we're not able to enter some kind of process of developing that personally and then, of course, communally, all we're left with is right and wrong. And then all we're left with is choosing a side of who we think is right or wrong based on our personal lenses and habit patterns. So it's very limiting. And I think, in a way, I have hope that I think there's a decent amount of us who are pretty sick of this. You know, we're sick of war and we're sick of violence and we're sick of, you know, seeing suffering, but we're also sick of like people trying to force us into binaries all the time. To me, Buddhism is not the only thing, but Buddhism does offer us a way out, because it offers us the freedom of opening to like a way to look at interdependence and relationships and to ask more questions than to have more answers, which, as you said, can open into empathy. Like I can see both sides' positions, you know, in the Israel-Palestinian conflict over many years. For some reason, like that's not, people aren't satisfied with it. If you see both sides, then you're choosing either apathy in some people's eyes, or you're choosing to sort of, how do you say it, diminish the side that they think is suffering more, right?
Yeah.
So it's really tricky.
This deepest principle of Buddhism of emptiness, interdependence, is about transcending dualities. And there couldn't be a bigger duality than choosing a side in a war, right? That one side's right and the other side's wrong. My understanding, and you know, my own perspective of a Buddhist interpretation is the side you take is the side of humanity. You know, the side of human beings, that every human being has a right to life, has a right to safety, security. I think nobody doesn't want peace. It's not, we live in peace. It's very nice to be able to walk down the street and not worry about being killed or bombed. It gives your life, you know, so much sense of safety, meaning, security. So to acknowledge like that's at the root of this anger is some kind of need. And again, the kind of obvious one in this case, a need for safety, security, health, nonviolence.
And you're just naming this basic one of like this need for safety, which is, I don't want to comment on you, but you know, I grew up in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, you know, in a fairly privileged upbringing. I had my fair shakes of ups and downs, but in fairly privileged in the sense that, you know, now I live in Latin America for the last 3 years. And my wife and other friends and things like that, they don't, Latin America is not as dangerous as people think it is. I will say that. It depends where you are. It depends, you know, who you are and how, sometimes, unfortunately, how much money you have. But what I do notice is embedded in my wife and others I talk to is a real concern about like the basic safety you were talking about, you know,
yeah.
Be able to walk down the street, you know, not get into some physical altercation, or you know, someone's going to take something from you, or you know, there's an internal war happening or something like that. And so you know, that culturally wasn't something I grew up with, so it's very now having to like listen to others and see and respond to their concerns that are different than mine. It's sort of like it makes me think about even safety as an idea. And I mean, we can define safety on these basic levels, which I think a lot of people would agree with, like physical safety, things like that. And then I think there's like, it just made me think about how we frame safety as an individual too. Meaning like, you know, I don't want to comment on anyone in particular, but I have noticed that sometimes having the trauma of growing up in unsafe environments creates a situation where those can appear when maybe there's not necessarily that safety concern. I've seen that happen to people I know. And, you know, where I'm this kind of hapless, you know, gringo, like, you know, I don't think about it that much, you know, unless I'm in certain cities that I know I have to be more careful. But, you know, I don't think about it that much, which is maybe like not so healthy because maybe I should be more concerned with it. And it's a little bit of a privilege to be able to have that take. But anyways, I was just reflecting on this. My question here is like, where's that barrier between actual safety like that is just foundational for us human beings and like we're part of our concern about safety is actually more cognitive and emotional, you know, and cause I see that being blurred a little bit.
Yeah, it is tricky. And also coming from a place of, you know, progressive privilege. I live in Berkeley, California now.
Yeah,
you know, these political divides, one of the saddest things I think, but understandable things I hear people say is, I don't understand how that person could vote for that person, or how that person could have this perspective on the conflict, or how they could go to that protest or whatever. That fundamentally, from a Buddhist perspective, like I find, if I say that to myself, I don't understand, that's an invitation to understand that you really want to, because it is understandable. Like everybody's actions make sense to them from the cause and effect, you know, from their birth, their culture, their politics, and so on. So like this one about safety, I think is a great one, because it's quite easy in Berkeley, California to be unarmed and to let, you know, my 12-year-old daughter roam freely around and for me to walk around safely. But for a person, for example, living in a very dangerous neighborhood in Los Angeles, you know, that person might want to have a gun in their home is understandable. And go away from statistics and so on and things like that, because there may be good reasons not to do that. But from a psychological perspective, it makes absolute sense. You want to defend your family. You want to feel safe. You've already experienced violence and crimes and so on right there in your home and in your neighborhood. Same thing with someone living in like a rural, you know, say a more right wing person living in rural Mississippi or Texas or something like that. You're isolated there with a lot of space around you, and you want to, same thing, you want to protect your family, you want to protect your home. like, it makes sense to that person too, you know, to be armed for that, to feel safe. And they may have faced, you know, real conflicts in their life. It's not just imagined. They faced, you know, real situations where someone else was armed. You can, you know, extend that to the very difficult mental exercise of trying to understand the most extreme perspectives, like in this Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Because, of course, it's not every Israeli, it's not every person in Gaza and the West Bank, you know, who has these perspectives. It's more the most extreme factions, like the Israeli government, had a very quite extreme, you know, right-wing perspective, and then like the Hamas, like a very extreme, violent perspective. But to do that exercise, if you're ready to actually try to see the cause and effect, not that what they're doing is, quote, right or beneficial, but just that there's a logic to why they are acting that way. Say the person in Gaza, who they were a child, whose parents were killed in a bombing and so on, and then they got radicalized. Like, you can see, if you think through it and you do a little bit of reading and research, you can see how people get radicalized on both sides. And then the Buddhist perspective is that that's not just out of the goodness of your heart that you do that mental exercise of trying. If you're going to fight for peace and justice and human rights, you really need to understand, you know, and you need to understand the person you're in conflict with. You'll actually be better at resolving that conflict if you understand the other side. Sorry to go on and on about that, it's deep.
I love it. But anyway, so I think thinking globally and opening our minds is great. But if we don't act locally, it's not good, you know? Meaning, like, there's very little I actually can do to change the situation in, you know, between the conflict of Palestinians and Israelis. I'm not saying there's nothing. There are things, obviously, through our political system, et cetera, in the United States we can do. Because, obviously, we didn't talk about it. The United States is a pretty major player in
the very big force, yeah.
For as long as I've been alive and more. But I think, you know, we're forgetting that, like, so what's happening is, like, we're almost losing our agency because we're not exerting efficacy or agency where we actually have it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Which is locally.
Yeah.
Meaning locally, I mean, like, as locals, just our families.
Right? Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, you know, the a friend of mine, Bjarke Ingels, this great architect, he said this great thing once that I love. He said, you know, if you only define yourself by what you're against, you are merely a follower in reverse. You know, because you're sort of being dragged. Like, and I that really resonated with me, because if you really only say, like, I'm against this leader, I'm against this country, I'm against this policy, whatever. No, you really need to be for something. And the really most effective people in the world in general have been for something. But it's also hard to have hope. You know, it's hard to see, like, it does feel really, really hopeless with this kind of conflict. And, you know, something that's helped me is, again, like this sense of, like you're saying, this sense of context. You know, we were at war with Germany, you know, in the 1940. They were our arch enemy. Japan also, right? Now these are two of our closest allies. Like, this is interdependence, right? This is change and interdependence and fluidity. Like, a starting point to even feel like you can be the tiniest bit effective is to see that things have already changed a lot, even over the course of our lifetimes and our parents' lifetimes. You know, Germany is one of our closest allies. They were absolutely our arch enemy. We each killed millions of each other's people. Like, just like this other conflict. Same thing with Japan. Japan was willing to have the very last Japanese person die in order to fight the United States, in order to lose to the United States even, like that level of commitment to the war. And we are now, you know, the closest of allies.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this is one question I'll just put out there, and then maybe I could say something a little bit about the Vajrayana
view
on this, right, to kind of come back around, because it relates. And the question is more around you know, I think we don't think about this a lot. Like, what are we putting our hope in? And is that a reliable thing to put our hope in? So again, I don't want to put out there some kind of religious idea. I just want to say it because I think it's useful. Is, you know, Buddhism doesn't have the idea that the world, that there's like a better world. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't have that premise that somehow we're going to fix the world, you know? It has the premise based on what we've already been talking about, and to make it very practical and relatable, that as long as one or two or three individuals or more are beholden or controlled by their afflictive emotions, that suffering and violence is going to ensue, right? That's the premise. And so I think, to me, that's kind of revolutionary because it changes how we work with ourselves. It changes how we think of conflict and how we seek to resolve it, right? Kind of back to His Holiness's advice and what we've been threading throughout this of like really coming back to responsibility for our own thoughts and emotions in understanding that they're not as real as they appear, first of all, and that they're quite harmful if we don't work with them, you know? So I just wanted to say that I think, you know, this is a tricky one. And I'm not saying anybody has to believe that or you or anyone, but through a lot of reflection, I have that conviction now that I don't think the world is fixable. But, and this could go into the Vajrayana view a little bit, but the world is also not fixable because there's nothing to fix. Mm-hmm. And this is can be a very controversial idea in Buddhism, actually, and can be a very challenging idea. It needs to be also filled in by teachings in Vajrayana Buddhism that I'm not going to give here, obviously.
One way of looking at Vajrayana is just looking at how things could be. Looking that, you know, our nature is fundamentally good and trying to see what the world would look like if we realize that, right? And so in Vajrayana, you know, there are aspects of Vajrayana that are secret and aspects that are open to everybody, at least in our tradition. I led a war meditation for the podcast, I don't know, about a month ago. You know, in a Vajrayana, you find a lightness. Like, so you find a real lightness in yourself and you imagine that you travel there to the Middle East and look down and really see the suffering on both sides and then imagine it different. You know, that imagine giving those people safe homes, security, all the resources they need, the security of knowing their whole life they're going to be safe, their loved ones, their friends, for anyone who's lost people in the conflict, giving them the ability to eventually get over that and heal from that pain. Like even saying it right now, it actually feels quite good, you know? And that's the thing is like, you can't just be against something. You need to be for something. And also it's not just abstract. You can't just say I'm for peace. That's not powerful. From the Vajrayana perspective, you really need to picture it. And it's not saying that this is some airy fairy magic that my thinking is going to solve this conflict, but it warms your own heart. And it makes your own actions become genuine causes, or more closely, you know, toward genuine causes for peace. And also, just practically, I think people are in anguish in the United States and everywhere else, people listening right now. So it also just helps you get past that anguish to, you know, just feeling okay. And that, you know, there is, at least picturing a solution is the first step towards having one. And I think a lot of people don't do that. We're focused in the conflict, but picturing what a solution looks like is the absolute important step on the way towards having one.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to say, so I'm just it's very superficial what I'm saying, but we imagine this world and ourselves and others as a pure Buddha field. Again, like you said, it's not for the sake of ignoring suffering and just magical thinking. That's not the point. The point is actually to open our minds to another possibility in reality, which I've found to actually do the opposite of magical thinking. I found it to help me to be more engaged, more practical, more connected with others.
Exactly. Just something to help us loosen and soften and stay open and connected to the people around us. You kindly agreed to lead a meditation that would bear on these issues of what's the right thing to do and conflict and the other. Can you just talk a little bit about what that meditation is? And it'll air as the next episode after this interview.
Sure. I was thinking we could meditate a little bit on an equanimity practice. And the reason this came to mind is because I find we can access a lot of loving kindness meditations and compassion meditations out there in very secular and spiritual forms. But often, if I'm not meditating on an equanimity, if I'm not having some connection to that, the love and compassion can still be biased. There can be some sense of like one person or one group being more important than another. And I think based on our conversation, you know, in different conflicts, you know, in particular the Israel-Palestinian conflict right now, equanimity is so needed, you know, because I think then proper action can come from that, right? And again, we're not defining what that action is necessarily today, but I think there's some prep work to do before that. And so equanimity is part of that.
Yeah, that sounds great, because it's one thing, I think everybody listening would probably say they believe in universal human rights, but it's one thing to say it, another to feel it. And that's what that meditation can really do. So great. Well, I'm looking forward to doing it. I'll do the meditation with you right now. And for people listening, it's the episode following this. Well, thank you so much, Scott. It's a wonderful discussion. As always, I really appreciate you opening up and about your personal experience, and I hope it's a benefit to anybody who listened this far.
Yeah, me too. Thanks for all your wisdom, Scott. I think we ventured into a lot of areas, so I do hope it's helpful to some of the listeners out there.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for joining us for our conversation with Scott Tusa. Next week's episode is a guided meditation that Scott leads us on equanimity, a technique for equalizing our feelings toward friends, strangers, and even enemies. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider making a donation to our podcast. A Skeptic's Path to Enlightenment is a nonprofit organization. Our podcast is free and ad-free thanks to our generous donors. To support us now, visit our website at skepticspath.org. We accept cash, credit, Bitcoin, and other cryptocurrencies, and your donations are tax deductible in the US. If you'd like to deepen this conversation, please join our private meditation community and newsletter through the links on our website, or follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks to Annie Nguyen for production and story editing, Christian Parry for mastering, and Isabella Acebel for marketing. We wish you a wonderful day.